Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polysbon, and I'm joined today by Anne Dudek, Zohar Adkins, Stuart Alsop III, and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, everybody. I'd like to remind everyone watching or listening that if you want to join our WhatsApp group, Chronicles, to discuss the meditations yourselves, the link is in the bio. And if you would like and comment on this video, that would be wonderful as well, because that would mean more people to discuss the meditations in Chronicles. All right, now on to the meat and potatoes. The quote of the day is by Kalidasa from The Recognition of Shakuntala, and it reads, "The darkness of the night that the sun is powerless to dispel, the moon can drive away." Nico, could you explain to us the origin of that quote and the author?
Yes. Perhaps our Indian audience would recognize who Kalidasa is and who and what the recognition of Shakuntala is. But basically, for everybody else, Kalidasa is to Sanskrit or to the ancient Indian literature called Kavya, what Virgil is to Latin. So we're talking about like the major poet of a tradition here. And the text, The Recognition of Shakuntala, is very important because beyond it, and like beyond it, what it means for the literary tradition of India, it was discovered in the 19th century by a German Indologist, and it was a big deal because The Recognition of Shakuntala is basically a tragedy, like a Greek tragedy. So probably the Scheller brothers were the ones who made a lot of work on this back in the 19th century. But the idea being that you find tragic tropes in other traditions, this being the Indian tradition. And we can talk about what tragedy is and the essence of tragedy. The quote we have today is, in a sense, isolated from the whole play, from the whole story. But the idea is that it's not a happy ending. and I'm not going to summarize. I could summarize the whole play, but that will be the main idea, is that there's a scheme to the whole story, which mimics or it's similar to, let's say, a play by Sophocles or by Aeschylus.
What is the allegorical or symbolic meaning of the quote, either in the context of the play or as a standalone, though? How do you think about these elements, the darkness of the night, the sun, and the moon?
So I'm going to go at it through as an isolated quote, because I don't remember exactly from what part of the play I got it, but it is poetic, first of all. That's one thing. If I have to interpret this on a totally personal level, like the idea, I don't want to get alchemical, as we always do, but there is something to be said about the light of the moon versus the light of the sun here. And I actually wanted to bring this. I wanted to bring this up, but I'm a bit embarrassed. I'm a terrible poet. I don't entertain poetic writing myself that much, because I think writing poetry today I take it as a bit of a narcissistic endeavor. But I do have, a short, it's not really a poem, but it's more of a personal rumination, where I have this idea that goes something like, it's in Spanish originally, so in English it would be, the perimeter of the moon is more sharp than the perimeter of the sun. And what would be a better translation of that would be,
the edge of the moon?
Exactly. The edge of the moon is sharper than the edge of the sun. So you can look at the moon and you can see its borders very clearly, right? When you look at the sun, you can't do that, or it's diffused. And there's a few things connected there with the idea of staring at the sun versus staring at the moon. Who stares at the moon, right? Everyone?
I stare at the moon.
You stare at the moon?
Yeah.
It's like the night versus the daylight, the moon versus the sun. It's funny because staring at the sun is a form of insanity.
Staring at the moon also is a form of insanity as well. I remember I went to
lunacy.
Exactly. Yeah. I went to this yoga training. I can't remember where I got the specific training. There was one point at which I might have discussed this on the show previous times. There was one point at which I started getting my yoga methods from Google itself. I would just start to search Google for yoga methods. And it was a horrible idea. It was a really bad idea because I got myself into all sorts of esoteric traps with all sorts of negative effects that I didn't see. And one of which was to stare at the moon on the full moon as the object of meditation. And that was quite a, I'll leave what happened after for a different show, but it's quite.
Okay. Can I get in on the action here?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
I want to talk about the light of the sun and the light of the moon in Jewish tradition, and also this idea of the sun being a source of clarity versus the moon being a source of luminosity. Descartes, famously, for those who know, is one of the first to try to describe the scientific method. And he thinks that the job of philosophy and science is to find things that are clear and distinct. That's his phrase. The sun is a kind of representation of clear and distinct. I think the moon is not distinct and not clear in the light that it provides. And obviously the moon also can wax and wane. We can disappear entirely. But what you get in from the moon is the glow of the darkness around the moon. I think that's to Nico's point about the sharpness of the perimeter. And on the eve before Passover, Jews search their homes for leavened bread. It's the last thing you do before Passover is you search for leavened bread in your house. And if you find any, you burn it the next morning. And you're supposed to search with a candle rather than a torch. And to this day, now we have electricity, people search in the dark for this chametz, it's called this leavened bread, because you're not allowed to have leavened bread in your possession for 8 days. When the Israelites left Egypt, they didn't have time for the bread to rise. And as a symbol of leaving in haste and having to eat this sort of this unfinished bread, that's why just why Jews eat matzah for 8 days on Passover. So you're not even allowed to possess bread-like objects during Passover. But you search for this bread with a candle, and it seems highly inefficient, to say the least, because if the purpose of finding the bread, if it's so important to find the bread, why wouldn't you just turn on the lights? Or why wouldn't you use a blazing torch? Why would you use a candle? And I'm going to emphasize the question even more intensely by saying that it's such a grave sin. I say sin in scare quotes, but it's such a grave sin to have bread in your possession during Passover. If you deliberately have bread in your possession during Passover, you're writing yourself out of the story, and the punishment is that you're cut off from your people and you lose your sort of share in the afterlife and all kinds of things. It seems disproportionate. But the point of it is that this is such a fundamental story that relating to the story in such a deep way determines whether you're in or you're out of the story. And the way that you participate is by cleansing yourself of bread. And so given that, given how high the stakes are, why search with a candle rather than a torch? Or why not search, to use this metaphor, with the sun, with the light of the sun in broad daylight rather than at night? And the answer given by the Talmud, or suggested by the Talmud, is that the purpose of the search isn't actually to find the bread, it's to light up the darkness. The final preparation isn't the success of the search. You've already done all the searching up until that moment. So if you're actually looking for bread at that moment, then you're not doing it right. Yeah. The capstone, the milestone for completing the search is no longer to search in a practical way, but to search specifically in this more obscure way. That's what I thought of when I heard this phrase, that the darkness of the night, that the sun is powerless to dispel, the moon can drive away, is that the moonlight, much like the candlelight, it's not utilitarian, it's not functional, it doesn't actually help you see in a clear and distinct way, but it does allow you to see the power of light contrasted with dark in a way that the overpowering torch or the overpowering sun does not allow. And so what that means, now to just hit it home, is that essentially you have, with light, you have an absolute basis and a relative basis. Same with value. If I say, what's the value of something, you can say on absolute terms or on relative terms. Like a dollar has an absolute value, but it also has a relative value to a poor person versus a billionaire. A dollar is worth more or less depending on the utility of that dollar. Mm-hmm. So on an absolute basis, we can say that the light of the sun is better than the light of the moon. It's more powerful. But on a relative basis, the light of the moon is more powerful than the light of the sun, because the light of the moon allows us to see the darkness, whereas the light of the sun does not allow us to see the darkness. And the reason why it's important to see the darkness is because from that, you can actually see the power of the light. Whereas when you don't see the darkness, you don't even realize the power of the light. So I'll pause on that and curious what Anne thinks from like a design and like color theory and other perspective on this.
Yeah, I think I really understood it in the idea of like explicitness, right? And so even outside the physical reality of light perception, I think especially in art, it's making things explicitly known versus implicitly understanding them. And I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, like my own depression and how I navigate that. And I think that the sunlight is reading medical tech on depression and getting this very explicit, very illuminated, like understanding of depression. And then the moonlight is, I would say, going and looking at a Rothko painting and allowing myself to feel all of his emotions that he had, especially at the end, towards the end of his life. And kind of finding power in looking at something from the side or looking at it in moonlight, where you seek other methods of understanding rather than just explicit knowledge. And so I think it's much similar to what you just talked about, Zohar, where I think artists love the moon, and especially Nico, as you read more poetry on your days off, find a lot of them talking about the moon. And it's because, like, how do you describe love? Like, in explicit words, it's not going to, that's sunlight. That's not going to happen. But moonlight can shed some understanding on what it feels like to be in love or in pain types of things.
In Genesis, it says that God made two great lights, I believe. Or it says that God made great lights. And there's a commentary on this, which is, what were the great lights that God made? And there's an amazing Talmudic passage on this that says that the great lights were the sun and the moon. And so then there's a dialogue between the sun and the moon that's imagined, where the moon says to God, how can there be two great lights? There should only be one great light. Like, it's the equivalent of how can there be two kings? And God says, you're right, now diminish yourself. And that's how the moon became small. And also, as we know, the light of the moon is literally just a reflection of the light of the sun. It doesn't have its own light, its own independent light. Unfortunately, the moon is a satellite, if you will. And then the moon says in response something to the extent of, it doesn't seem fair that I should be diminished, like simply for asking a good question. Like, I pointed out a truism about the way of things, and now because I did that, like, you're exiling me. And God says, like, I never said, I'm interpolating a little bit, but I never said that being diminished is a bad thing. That's your shtick. That's your value judgment. Look at all of these characters throughout the Bible who are referred to as the small, and what great giants they are. And so you actually your work as the moon is to appreciate the contribution, the great contribution that you can make from the place of diminishment. So don't discount the side hustle or the side angle, or to Anne's point, like, you don't have to be the main show to get the glory. There's in some ways more power, more delta, more opportunity from being in the position of the underdog or being in the position of the little one. I was talking to a friend who works in finance, and he said about a company, won't mention which one, that has really good margins. I think their margins are like 80% or something like this. And he said, what's bad about that? And I tried to think of an answer. What is bad about having such good margins? And he says, the fact that they can't get better. And thus, you can't assign a valuation multiple to the company on the theory that they can improve their margins because their margins are already quite exceptional. Even if they get them up another 5%, it's not going to be the driver. So I think that's where we might say about the sun is you get it already. Oh, yeah, we get it. Like the sun, it's awesome. Whereas the moon, because it's discounted, has this opportunity to surprise us.
Yeah, I actually, another thought I had when reading the quote was like the idea of hard and soft power in politics. And especially like hard power would be this military, this sunlight, this kind of thing. But then soft power, honestly, I thought of South Korea and the rise of K-dramas, the rise of K-pop, and like how much this has brought attention and commerce and all these things to South Korea. And yeah, I think it's this idea that your point, Zohar, that the biggest and the brightest is not always what's necessary in certain situations. It's not the only way to achieve power or elimination or knowledge or things like that.
Is there another way to interpret the quote about the moon? You mentioned at near the beginning, Zohar, like the moon isn't always the same. Waxes and wanes, and sometimes it's not even there. But it is there. What if the quote is, it's about the fact that the moon is there when the sun isn't? So maybe the darkness of the night, the sun is powerless to dispel, because the sun isn't there during the night by definition. And it's so you don't, and then so maybe it's saying you don't necessarily need the cavalry. You've got the moon right here. The moon will suffice. Turn toward the moon. In this hour, the moon will be your friend. This, the smallest comfort can work. The smallest comfort is enough. And sometimes it's the smaller things, the less important things that show up when you need them the most, when what you usually depend on isn't there. That's what I was picking up on it.
I think that's the plain and basic interpretation in a good way. Right now, obviously, it's about to be the winter solstice. So I'm also thinking about the length of days getting longer and shorter, and darkness as also a seasonal thing. Obviously, that's why we have Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa and so many, and in ancient times, Saturnalia, so many festivals of light in the winter pick up on this idea that it's not just the specific darkness that people find to be uncomfortable, but actually a kind of like the prospect of darkness as this ongoing thing, and how will we ever get to spring again? If it was just a night of darkness, we could deal with it. But it's the shortening of the days and then the continuing darkness day over day, where you can think of darkness as a kind of sustained period of time, not just as the darkness of, let's say, an evening, but the darkness as a kind of phase of life. And so what do you do in that time? You summon the power of the moon. You summon the power of the small light, not the magnificent light, but the little light. And that actually, in a weird way, is comforting. If you think of Christmas lights, there's something very beautiful about that. And if people just, again, to my point before, like you have football field lights and baseball field lights for night. If that was the response, it wouldn't be as powerful as, in a way, these tiny lights where you all of a sudden actually feel the significance of these things that aren't that seem on their own insignificant. There's just like a spiritual requirement to see ourselves as significant precisely in a moment of darkness, precisely in a moment of days getting shorter, which suggests that the world is ending and that our days are numbered and all of that. And again, just because I'm in Hanukkah mode right now thinking about this, the Talmud has another story about Adam, the first human being, who, imagine you were the first human being and you didn't know anything about seasons. Like, you've just been created, and now all of a sudden, for the first time, you experience the shortening of days. Wouldn't you be super freaked out? So Adam has just eaten from the tree of knowledge and has been punished, right, for doing so. He and Eve have been cast out of Eden. They were told by God that on the day that they eat from the tree of knowledge, they shall surely die. And now Adam's looking around, wondering, okay, when's my death sentence? And the days are getting shorter. And it's, oh, I guess this is it. And gets super anxious. And then realizes after the winter solstice that, no, the days are getting long again. And it's passing. And so the next year, and there's a difference of opinion on this, but the next year basically invents Hanukkah or some proto-Hanukkah, invents a festival of light as a way of either celebrating the fact that he made it through the previous year and he survived, or perhaps, as we say on Twitter, as a coping mechanism, to feel that even though it looks like you're dying, don't worry, you're not dying. So that's what the light represents. And maybe that's what the moonlight provides as well, as the sense of, I know it's very scary, but like, you'll get through this.
Yeah. And, oh, Stuart, were you going to say something?
So I want to go back to that seasons. The idea of seasons is really interesting for me because for the past, since 2019, and a lot of my 20s, I was essentially living in places where the seasons were very different from my homeland. Lots of times in tropical countries. But for the past 4 years, I've been spending the summer in the Northern Hemisphere and then spending the summer in the Winter Hemisphere, and essentially a constant summer. Yeah. And so now this year is the first time that I fully made the transition over into the Southern Hemisphere. And so my summer is now your winter, and it is playing some big tricks on my mind because in my biology, I'm on winter time right now. And everybody in my network is on winter time right now, but I'm on summer. Days are getting longer. Like, now this is great. So it's definitely, and that ties in with the moon too, because you can track the sun. I know the path that the sun is going to go on every day in my hometown. I know where the light comes into my house in the morning, but I have no idea what's happening in the moon. Total chaos.
And also the summer.
Okay. I think it's that, like, the moon is commonly associated with tragedy. Like in a lot of stories, the moon is feminine, and the reason it waxes and wanes is pieces of it were stolen, or like some nefarious activity, like this tragedy that led to the waxing and the waning of the moon. I'm not super familiar with this text, but there's like the moon and its association with tragedy and this quote play into the poetry here, or the larger narrative of the story?
No, to be honest, I think this is a standalone, but I'll give you a nice explanation of something else, which I think ties to. I think this is just and there's a play and someone says something and someone throws some sort of poetic wisdom into the mix. And that's the way this quote is working in the text. But what I wanted to say is that, especially in like the ancient Roman and the Greek context, we know we normally said lunacy right at the beginning of the Zohar, said lunacy, and we talked about like the symbolism of the moon as being connected to insanity or to like madness, because the night, no, that's where like we dream, we can't see clearly things. But the interesting thing is that for the ancient Romans and the Greeks, night was not the time of lunacy, or let's say of insanity or of madness. It was actually noon. Noon was I have a book right here that I was like, it's called The Demons of Noon.
That's
Roger Calois, a French author from the 20th century. So at noon, that's the time of insanity. And I feel like that. My life is a little bit like that. I'm a night person.
But why?
This is a beautiful idea, and it makes a lot of sense, because when the sun is up, like perpendicular, like 90%, 90 degrees up, you can't see your shadow.
You cannot see your shadow.
There's no contrast, as you were saying initially. There's no clear distinction between what is dark and what is bright. And that points back to the edge of the moon is clearer than the edge of the sun. And you can get Jungian about this, because what happens when you can't see your shadow?
Wait, did I tell you guys about the shadow of the shadow? Oh, wow. I'm excited.
Yeah, just to wrap it up, there is this kind of popular association between clarity and darkness, the sun and the moon. the male and the female, right? Because sol and luna, this is an alchemy also, but like the feminine versus masculine. But I don't know, I feel attuned to this idea that madness happens at noon, not at midnight.
The Talmud is full of demonology. So we can do with that, we can do with that what we will. We can view it as a construct or a kind of play, or you can imagine that they actually believed in demons and just had a completely different worldview than ours. You can, I'm not going to get into the,
what is a demon?
The sort of the history of how it was the case that for a long time, people did believe in demons and what those were, just as they believed in angels. You can obviously read Dan Brown's novels as well to think about that, but you can also ask, what are the angels and demons of our time? But nonetheless, there's an anthropology of demon that's called demonology, which is like, what makes a demon? And the Talmud loves asking these kinds of questions in addition to what makes a demon. Also, how do you discover if something is or isn't a demon? And in this discussion, there's a suggestion that human beings and demons both cast shadows, but demons do not have a shadow of a shadow. Again, you can, what is a shadow of a shadow? You might be able to go to Wikipedia and look up penumbra or parallax. There's various scientific sort of discussions about shadows that cast shadows and the physics of it. And you can actually see examples of it in photography of shady rooms that have different shades within shades and all that kind of thing. But I think about it more evocatively as the shadow of the shadow. If it is the thing that humans have, but demons don't, it's like this thing that's super subtle, that is the receipt, the material receipt that's barely material, that suggests the difference between a soul and a non-soul. I think that's very interesting also in light of AI discussions. You often hear people, especially on the doomer decelerationist side of the culture war, so to say, but AI doesn't have a soul, and therefore it's not going to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And without wading into the ontology of AI, I think about, maybe is the AI a demon where it can do everything that a human being can do or will be able to do one day, but it won't have a shadow of a shadow, whatever that means. In any case, that's some background to think about, is just why define the human being as that which casts a shadow's shadow, but the demon as not. So I'll be curious for your thoughts on that, but I have to give you one piece of information on this first, which is when a person is looking for, what's the word, like a sign or an omen as to how their year is going to go, there's various things that they can look for. And generally, this gets into sort of sorcery and prophecy and all kinds of things that are like, might be pagan and might be problematic from a strictly monotheistic point of view, but it's still in the Talmud as, yeah, people engaged in this and maybe it's okay or whatever. Again, I'm not going to weigh in on the details. So there's a story about a man who is about to undertake a large journey, and he wants to know if his journey is going to go well. And so they suggest that if he wants a sign, that he should go into a dark house. And if he sees a shadow of a shadow, then I believe that is a positive omen for his journey. But this is my favorite part of the story. It's so unlikely that he will find the shadow of the shadow. Because after all, how do you find a shadow of a shadow in a dark home? Completely dark home. So he shouldn't do it. He shouldn't go looking for the sign, because if he fails to find the omen, he will fall into a despair, and then his journey won't go well, and it will become a kind of self-fulfilling, terrible journey. Even though I think the text offers this idea that there are omens and they're real, it also gives practical advice, which is, hey, maybe you don't want to get too neurotic about looking for omens, because if you don't get the omen you want, that's going to lead to a psychological state that will itself have consequences. So maybe just suspend your view of how magical reality is and just focus on what you can do to make the journey a good journey, and don't worry too much about whether it's going to go well for you. Because if you do, like, the neurosis itself is going to make it a bad journey. Anyway, yeah. How do you fit the two texts together? The fact that demons don't cast a shadow of a shadow, and the fact that, I guess, presumably if he's in the house and he finds the shadow of the shadow, this is like, he's seeing himself, or he's seeing his soul, or something positive. It's a sign of vitality, but he's not going to find it. And it's almost, okay, I'll give you my interpretation. if a man tries to distinguish himself from a demon, he will fail. So don't get too worried about what makes me not a demon, because in a weird way, that would turn your life into a demonic life. So just live and let live. Philosophy and theology aren't going to help you on these fundamental questions. Maybe AI and man are the same, but you know what? Chaim, like, go on your journey and chill.
Now I'm going to go.
Tell that to Socrates.
Chill, bro.
The unexamined life isn't worth living, but the examined right. one may not be livable.
And now I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have to go train at GPT on giving me good omens and bad omens.
I would say
it's against open AI. Let's see.
AI is definitely not demonic for sure. Like, I have a pretty clear definition for what a demon is. It's very synthetic. It's a liminal being. This is the classic of the definition, right? The daimon, like in the Greek, the daimon is, no? It's something that is between two worlds. And that's why Socrates had one. Like, all of the wisdom of Socrates actually comes from a daimon, which is Sophia.
And the moon is a liminal being as well, because it's like the sun, but obviously not the sun. It's like a hybrid of earth and sun. Maybe that's the liminality of the moon is worth its advantage and its source.
My question is, are we liminal beings?
Yes.
Yes? Explain.
Yes.
I never explained myself. Just kidding.
I dream every.
Because I may have sort of bizarre philosophies in the back of my head running all the time, as many people do, but I'm more maybe open about them. But essentially, it's my belief that humans are part spirit. Some humans are part spirit, part. And some humans are full animal, and that there's just division in the spirit realm, or there's division among humanity of how in tune some people are to, and there's nothing wrong with being just a pure animal, but there's some division between a large amount of human beings, between spirit and human. And there's a liminal aspect to both too, because the animal may be liminal as well. So what's the definition of liminal?
Something that cool. Being in the threshold, you're defined by the capacity of going through thresholds.
I think everything is liminal. Everything is liminal, but human beings are, our liminality includes the fact that we're aware of our liminality in a conscious way. And animals are not yet aware of their liminality. So they suffer their liminality, but they don't fashion an identity on the basis of it. Like, I think we all have names, and even though Stuart and Anne and Cyrus and Nico and Zohar are names that other people have as well, we speak from our names and we respond when our name is called. And animals are not called by their name. They're called by their category. And I know that animals do communicate with one another, but I don't think if I had ChatGPT 7 and it could eavesdrop on the elephants and train a neural net on elephant sounds, I don't think that one elephant is going to say to the other, "Hey Tom, can you pass the cheese," or whatever. They will still, they're aware of one another. They still have specific relationships, but they don't have names.
Okay, this is a kind of warps for me. Like, I have so many things to say about
it. I think they have a liminality, but it's not as rich as our liminality. Our liminality has something to do with specifically the first person perspective tied to the names that we carry. And even in the sort of, and perhaps this is more of a male perspective here, because we talked about this before, Anne, about creation as maybe something that, if you have life-giving power, that you don't feel this as much. But make a name for yourself. The idea of you are given a name, but you also have a reputation, and you care about creating a certain legacy that's attached to your name in some way. I don't think animals have projects. I don't think that the elephant says, in 20 years, I want my name to be on a building. And I want to author a book because I want to be cited, and I'm not saying that those are good. There's obviously an aspect of narcissism in it, but so for me, that's what the human liminality is that it's like our diamond is in a very basic way, the name as our second self. and you have this sort of persona that hangs around your name that you manage in some way.
So is the diamond the persona, the shadow of the shadow? And a demon doesn't have that because it is a shadow waiting to be attached to someone.
Demons actually have names, but I wonder if they care about their reputations. When God says to Abraham, go to this place that I'm going to show you and I will make your name great. And what does that mean? And obviously we refer to the Abrahamic religions to this day, suggesting that Abraham's name in fact is great. Like millions of people cite Abraham as the founder of their tradition. Seems like a self-fulfilling text. But in a more constrained way, God might be saying to Abraham, you're about to leave your social network. This is pre-LinkedIn. And you're going to go from being a guy that everybody knows and thinks highly of to being a stranger in another land where no one's going to know who you are and no one's going to trust you and nobody's going to be able to check for references or see if you got referrals. But don't worry, I'm going to make your name great. Somehow, despite the fact that you'll be on your own, which is a socially vulnerable thing, your name will still emerge as something that has currency wherever you go. So yeah, I think that's a fascinating way to think about demons, that the shadow's shadow is the name in some way. I hadn't made that connection before.
Giving Dracula vibes. Can't see him in the mirror.
There's an interesting thing on this too, as well, because I've been watching this vampire show, and so the vampire represents an interesting relationship to the sun, which is that they get burned by the sun. And also, I think it is a counter story to the traditional enlightenment story, because I believe the enlightenment story is essentially the person that's associated with the body and mind gets annihilated by the process to enlightenment. And on the vampire, it's the opposite. The process of the body, the personhood that's associated with the body and mind also gets annihilated, but it gets taken over by demons, or it's replaced by a demon, the demonic presence.
I can offer like one clarifying point that might serve like this distinction between, this goes back to your point on the fact that there's people who only have an animal nature and people who have a spiritual nature as well. Like, I don't want to get too technical, but like when you read Hegel, no, Phenomenology of Spirit, there's a passage, or there's a few passages in the beginning of the, because all of the, especially the phenomenology part, is about Geist, no, spirit, and the journey of Geist, no, to, it's a kind of a journey of self-recognition. And one of the initial stages of the Geist is you have an animal, no? And in order for the Geist to go to the next stage, the animal needs to be sacrificed. And there's a way of reading this that, I'm not going to rest on this because it's complicated. There's a few texts that are like going around my mind, but the idea that what we call the human is exactly the sacrifice of the animal or of the animal nature. And what does that mean? It means that, let's say, we have quote unquote animal instincts. You get angry, you want to go and kill a person, or you're horny, you want to go and do your business, whatever. But we abstract from that, right? We, in a sense, sacrifice pulsion, the instinct to do that. And there's a variety of ways of understanding this. Like, this is perhaps the origin of guilt, the origin of consciousness, in fact, also can be that as well. But to the extent that there are people who don't have any guys, I don't know, because to me that points goes back to the whole distinction between the animal and the human, which I have a lot of problems with, because at least myself, my question is, do we really know what animals are up to? This goes back to the AI thing from last time.
Yes.
I look at the, like, this can be a stupid meme, but with cats, no? People look at cats or dogs and there's, oh, and they take care of their cats and their dogs is better than they take care of other people. And I think instinct, like, unconsciously, or not even consciously, they say, I would love to be a cat, because the cat, like, doesn't have to deal with all of the mundane and the responsibilities and all of these things. Hmm. So
it's like a patron of the arts. Oh, I'd love to be an artist and not worry about it.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think animals are a mystery at the end of the day, to me at least, and to the extent that they will continue to exist in the future as well, as like self-originating species.
Nico, have you ever seen a cat cam? Like one of those cat cams on the internet?
What is that?
People hook up little cameras to their cat's collars and yeah. they just leave the cat for the day, and you, okay. you can go and see what the cat does. And it has this whole second life out yeah. in the neighborhood.
Oh,
the
yeah. Remember that funny meme of the priest reading the Bible and the cat goes into his tunic and there's a party going on inside the priest's tunic?
I think that the example of cats and dogs are unique from the category of animals because they're domesticated. So they're uniquely liminal in a way that, let's say, a jaguar or a lion is not. I did watch that Netflix special about the guy that had pet lions or whatever. It was pretty pretty tiger. Appalling.
Tiger King, yeah. It's from a Wolfpack documentary.
Quite thing. But it's like some animals are domesticatable, and we've actually been domesticating animals for a really long time, and other animals not. So I don't think that the category of animal is sufficient, but certainly there are animals we live among that are like extended members of the household and certainly perceive, and we can ascribe a certain surveillance onto them, much like religious people in ancient times imagined that God or gods were watching them. And so you can't hide from your cat, whether even if the cat isn't wearing the cam, the cat knows. But I don't think that we feel watched by wild animals.
But we used to. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah, we had
years ago.
Maybe we had this sort of relation. Animals are charged. They're charged, but Heidegger would say they're charged for us, meaning like ultimately whatever we say about animals, however we relate to them, we're relating to ourselves vis-a-vis them, whereas we have no intimation that they're doing the same vis-a-vis us.
Something to say more business, but
I want to talk about my emu. I want to talk about my emu pet.
You have an emu?
You have an emu?
I have an emu. And I'll just
what is an emu?
An emu is the second largest bird in the world, and it's flightless. As the same as its cousins, the ostrich, which is from South America, and the rhea, which is from South America.
At that point?
What's that?
Nothing.
So,
I'm 6'5", and my emu is as tall as me. And I also have goats and sheep, and those goats and sheep are highly domesticable, as Zohar was talking about. They're part of the family. But the emu is the strange, charismatic bird that does not feel like it has any sort of self-referential awareness whatsoever. It doesn't feel part of the family. It's really awkward when I come and touch it. It's not like friendly or anything like that. And they can be very dangerous. And they can either be socialized or not. If they're not socialized, you don't want to get anywhere near an emu, because they're so dangerous. But that's all I'll say about my emu.
I don't think we're going to be able to leave it there, Stuart. That's going to...
No, what I was going to say is, can we trace a direct relationship or an equal sign between domestication and consciousness, for that matter? We are the most domesticated animal.
I once did a long Twitter thread analyzing the book Brown Bear. What do you say? It's a great book. I highly recommend it. Many children's books really are wonderful on their own terms. But one of the things that I became aware of reading this book every night to my kids is the animals aren't looking at each other. The text goes, brown bear, what do you see? I see a red bird looking at me. But in fact, the red bird isn't looking at the brown bear, looking in the opposite direction. And so you can actually make quite a big deal about this kind of observation philosophically, that we want the animals to look at one another, but it's not. So anyways, yes, we teach children language, oftentimes with books, and those books often feature animals. And actually one of the ways that kids learn language is by learning the sounds that animals make. But I think that my theory is that you're indoctrinating is maybe too strong of a word. Inculcating, you're part of what it means for an infant, which is defined as a being without language, to join humanity, is that they have to learn the difference between themselves and the animals. So you objectify the animals in the book to teach the child that you're a human being, and that means that you have language, and that's why they're learning how to read specifically to distinguish yourself from the animal. Also interesting to think about.
The Jungle Book.
I'm like a little bit maybe interpolating too much on this point, but like this is a bombshell. So perhaps too sensitive a topic, but obviously in American history, slaves were forbidden from reading. Frederick Douglass and many talk about the liberating experience of learning to read, not just for the utilitarian function that you could, let's say, forge your papers or whatever, but that you gain a certain access to self-consciousness and to the world through reading. So it seems like reading has also been weaponized historically as a dividing line between those who are full members of society and those who are animals or treated like animals, which is why literacy is so important and often a leading indicator for social and economic progress. In more recent times, obviously, women's literacy, let's say in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan, has been a major touching point. And obviously, so anyways,
there's the argument that the printing press was the most important invention of history.
But in ancient times, the scribes were the only class that knew how to read and write. And for most of human history, reading and writing was a highly skilled privilege, if you will, and automatically puts you in the upper class. Whereas now, hopefully, the cost of reading and writing has gone down and more people can do it. And thus it's no longer a marker. It's no longer remarkable, but animals remind us that it is. Monkeys who write Shakespeare notwithstanding.
I just want to say two things. One is that before there was scripture, or let's say there was writing, you had language, or what we can call, let's say, parole, or just oral language. So if you look at today's example, which is comes from the Sanskrit, only had a script around, I would say, 2,000 years ago, but Sanskrit existed before that. It was oral transmission. And Sanskrit is a highly inflected language, it has cases. So if you didn't know Sanskrit, and most people didn't, that's the whole point. Same thing with Latin. You couldn't engage in religion, call it religion, theology, law, politics, philosophy, grammar. Same thing happened with Latin. Greek is a kind of a more complicated example, but the idea that it's not just the act of reading, it's not that the act of learning a language, it's what language also. And language is not just English, Spanish, French. There's coding is a language, right? Yes. Or there's a language of code. I remember this was about 10 years ago. I saw an interview or read an interview with Bill Gates, and they were asking Bill Gates, what would you study? Now, what language would you study in the future to be successful? And he gave a very interesting analysis. He says, look, in the 80s, or to say in the 70s, no? If you wanted to be successful, you would have to learn English because of global trade was starting. So if you didn't know English, you can, and global trade, since the British Empire, it has been an Anglo endeavor. After that, what was the next thing? It was learning how to use a computer. You get coding, you get now AI. So if you don't know how to use a computer, you won't be able to work, you won't be able to make money, et cetera, et cetera. And they asked him, what's the next? And he said COVID, but like biogenetics. So like coding, like the genes, the gene code, learning how to do genetic coding. And I think there is something to that. And you see that today, coders, programmers make way more money. It's a much more desired skill than most skills. Now it might be changing with AI, but still to the asymmetries of learning in that regard.
I don't know if this is contrarian or not, but I think that memes are the 21st century version of hieroglyphics. And I think that we're going to see more memes proliferate as a medium of communication, which is amazing that after so many years of actually abstracting from the image aspect of language, of written language, to the meaning aspect, that we're actually returning to the literalism of the image. That is cool.
There's a meme of that already, Zohar.
Damn.
Yeah, you got to make that meme and put it in the Chronicle groups.
Yeah, the meme is memes are hieroglyphics, always has been.
Aren't like literal, just because they're imagery. Like the whole point of understanding memes is that you have to have like layers upon layers of cultural awareness. So it's actually, there's a lot more inference that happens with memes than even like text, because you have to like do a lot of like understanding and asymmetrical connection to like actually get the joke.
Which makes me wonder, like,
sophisticated way of communicating.
Which makes me wonder, is that how hieroglyphics used to work? Because it would only have been used by a priest class at the time, and they had all their traditions. And
I think the distinction there is that since maybe Plato onwards, or since the Greeks for the last 2,500 years, because you look at someone like the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, and like a lot of his work is about this, that we have privileged speech over writing for a long time. And this is something happening in Plato. And once you get writing, it's at the detriment of memory and of a lot of other things, but memory. So once you start writing, your memory capacity wanes.
Yeah.
And this is not something that, so writing itself is just a form of copy of what happens in the voice. No, that's the idea. Thing is that the whole thing, what's beautiful about Derrida is that his work is exactly, no, the writing itself is saying something different. And you can read, it's an inversion of the whole thing. And a lot of his inspiration comes from the Egyptians, hieroglyphs, because that's exactly I don't know to what extent, I'm not an expert in Egyptology or papyrology or all these things, but it's a symbol in itself. It's not representing something that, it's like when you see, I don't know, a wolf, a hieroglyph of a wolf. It's not that the wolf is like the sound E. It's like Chinese works in a similar way, apparently, from what I understand. And so it's all these things with language. It's not that easy, I think, to say, okay, like writing is just the copy of a sound.
Yeah. How did we get from a quote about the moon to talking about animals and wolves?
And language.
The mundanity of the conversation that the sun cannot dispel, the full moon can turn into a werewolf. Anyways, guys, what a great conversation. Thank you for joining today. If you enjoyed the listen, again, check out the link in the bio, join the Chronicles group, and there are discussions like this every day. It's awesome. Have a good one.